Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm thrilled to have partnered with Mindful Chef in this second series of Food for Thought. Mindful Chef is all about convenience, quality, and balance, delivering simple, nutritious, and sustainably sourced fresh recipe boxes straight to your door. With dairy-free, gluten-free, and vegan recipes available, there is something for absolutely everybody. And what's more, for every meal sold, Mindful Chef donates a school meal to a child in need. You can save £20 across your first two boxes from Mindful Chef, plus get a free cookbook from the founders by heading to mindfulchef.com/foodforthought. Or if you use the code from this podcast, Food for Thought, when you order your first box, that will be applied. Hello, and thank you so much for tuning in to Food for Thought, a podcast on a mission to equip you with all the evidence-based advice you need to live and breathe a healthy lifestyle. I'm Rhiannon Lambert, a registered nutritionist, master practitioner, best-selling author of Renourish, A Simple Way to Eat Well, and founder of Retrition, London's leading private nutrition clinic. In each episode of this second series, I'll be joined by special guests, all of whom can be considered authorities in the world of well-being, so that together we can learn fact from fiction and empower the healthiest versions of ourselves with trusted expert advice. We spend quite a bit of time and effort nourishing our relationships, whether it's with your significant other, your pals, your parents, or your children. But what about your relationship with food? This relationship impacts not only our health, but for so many, it's closely tied to other relationships, including that with our own body. Our relationship with food is so important to health and wellness, happiness, yet there's a very fine line between thinking carefully about what we put into our bodies and obsessing over it, restricting it dangerously. To help us make sense of it all is Joshua Woolrich, an NHS surgical doctor whose everyday work with patients and own significant weight loss experience have given him a unique insight as to how we should all build a healthy relationship with food. Hello, Joshua.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. I mean, it's one of these discussions I've wanted to have with you for a very long time. And of course, your job in general leads to so many different avenues. But what about from doctor to relationship with food? Can you talk me through that a little bit?
As in how that happened?
Yeah, how does that happen?
See, it's complicated. So I hope you've got, how long have we got? We've got time.
We've got time.
No, it is complicated because I grew up with kind of developing quite a poor relationship with food, or something that I've realized more recently. And so I kind of entered/exited my teenage years being quite overweight. I don't necessarily like that phrase, and I don't want to caveat every single thing I say, but people know what I mean when I say that. And that continued throughout university and as I graduated as a doctor. And I started feeling quite uncomfortable working as a doctor, seeing patients that at the time I thought it would be relevant to mention their size and their weight, and feeling like I couldn't. It felt to me like I was a smoker that was running a stop smoking service. And it therefore felt very hypocritical of me to be seeing patients and not feeling like I could really do my job properly, because I only had certain things that I felt like it was my, I had the ability to mention, let's say. So that started me down a journey of wanting to try and lose weight for something completely different to why I'd always wanted to in the past. And I'd always wanted to based on my self-worth and how I felt like other people saw me and what I felt it meant to me. And none of those reasons kind of followed through in my multiple years of trying to diet and doing all sorts of things like that. And so I think the one time when I had a different reason for it, I think I got quite lucky in that sense that I felt like I wasn't being the kind of as good a doctor as I could be, and I felt it was holding me back. So at that point, I wanted to do something about it. My opinion on whether I necessarily had the right motives at the time have slightly changed.
It's always the way.
Yeah, with kind of some of the stuff I've come across and my kind of attitude towards this kind of stuff. I had no idea what a relationship with food was when I started all this kind of stuff. And so I find it slightly difficult talking about why I chose to lose weight, because I don't want people to misinterpret what my current views are and what my current stance is on this kind of stuff. I'm sure we'll get into some of that stuff.
But... Well, yeah, it's very, very interesting to hear, of course, that you've mentioned two crucial things there, that as a doctor, you first of all felt a responsibility, I suppose, towards the impression you're putting out of yourself. But it's also quite a sad thing, because it does go to show that people are judged first and first foremost by their size or their shape, and that did affect how you felt with your self-esteem.
Yeah, of course. I don't think anyone can get away from the fact that society places so much worth on what we look like and our weight. We can kind of learn to recognize it and to kind of move forward with it. But I think, you know, if people aren't understanding of that kind of stuff, it's always something that will be affecting them.
Of course, and we know that weight isn't always an indicator of health. However, we do know that, of course, on the flip side, it can be with a lot of serious conditions. And would you say the proportion of your patients suffer from an illness which could be eased or even cured, let's say, through nutrition and lifestyle then?
I think that's a really difficult question to answer.
It's a big one.
So I work as a surgical trainee, currently within orthopedics. And there are certain conditions that I know diet and lifestyle most definitely have an impact on. For example, osteoarthritis. We know that the weight on the joints, and that weight is often related to diet and lifestyle, does make a difference.
Perhaps you could just explain to everyone what those terms mean. For
yeah,
instance,
sorry.
I'm sure there may be a few people listening.
That of course. Would, yeah. So, I mean, most people have a rough idea as to what arthritis is. It's mainly kind of an inflammation within the joints, leads to the joint line not being quite as smooth as it once was. And and often it leads to quite a lot of pain and discomfort and reduced movement in that joint. And we know that one of the factors for that is pressure through the joint or weight through the joint. So if we are of a higher weight, that increases the likelihood of osteoarthritis or arthritis developing, especially in our knees and hips and areas that take some of that load bearing.
Of course.
And that's not to say that it's a judgment call or it's a stigmatism. It's just pure kind of physics, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, that is fact, isn't it? Of course, the heavier you are, the more pressure on the joints. It does make sense.
Of course. So it's things like that. I know when I see patients, I know, there will be some element to diet and lifestyle here. The problem that I have is that I feel like as a community of healthcare professionals, we've done ourselves a disservice where we've put ourselves in a position at the moment where it's becoming incredibly problematic to mention anything.
Yes.
Because we've over the last however many years, we have spent so much time jumping to conclusions and making judgment calls based on someone's appearance and telling them what they should or shouldn't be doing without really looking into it and without really looking at the nuance. So something like arthritis is relatively straightforward. However, if we look at overall pictures of health, or we look at things like blood pressure related to someone's size, it's not as straightforward. And it's a very nuanced link. It's a very nuanced association. And so if every time we see someone that has high blood pressure, we tell them that they should lose weight, we're not doing them a good service. We're not treating them like a real patient. We're treating them like a statistic. And when we start treating real people like statistics, we miss a hell of a lot of stuff that just leads to poor patient care. So the reason why I said I struggle to answer that kind of question is because I find it quite hard. And I actually find that at the moment, it's not necessarily doing... it's doing more harm than good by trying to mention some of this stuff sometimes because people get this stuff mentioned to them every single time they see a doctor, whether it's relevant or not. And it leads to quite a lot of weight stigma, in my opinion. And so it's just something that's very difficult. And I think we need to be taking a step back and really looking at this kind of stuff. But we've kind of put ourselves in that position. And so we need to start taking responsibility for it, I think.
I think that's really wonderfully executed, actually, how you describe that, because it's true that we in society are very quick to judge or very quick to label the facts, the black and white facts, whereas there's a whole spectrum of colour that isn't necessarily included. And I think in an ideal world, wouldn't it be incredible if the NHS gave every single patient access to a psychologist and a nutritionist and a doctor? And we know that would be the wonderful 360 degree approach. But of course, we do sometimes have to rely on the stats, because there's just too many people for too small a service.
So. We do, but unfortunately I think that we're adding to the stats when we only rely on the stats. And what I mean by that is when we don't look at people's health in a holistic manner and we only focus on their weight, which often occurs, we tend to put people down a road of encouraging disordered eating, encouraging yo-yo dieting, and actually we end up putting people down a road where we actually encourage weight gain. And so I think we're adding to the stats by only focusing on the stats.
I completely agree. And I would be lying if I said I hadn't had numerous clients in my clinic reporting that perhaps it's a doctor that's told them something, it's stuck in their head, and then I'm working on unpicking this and working on their relationship with food. So it is very complex and very tricky. And you also mentioned, and you shared with us at the beginning, your journey and how you used to be overweight. But what about the crazy hours working as a junior doctor? Do you think that contributed to that as well? Perhaps it's very difficult to live a healthy lifestyle being a doctor yourself?
I think possibly. And I think, and let's say if you'd have asked me 3 years ago, I'd have gone, yeah, definitely. Yeah. But I think I was, in one way, I think my naivety led me to use that, or not as an excuse, but almost as a reason for it. And I think there is definitely 100% an element to being busy and not having much free time. There is definitely an element to that leading us to make slightly more convenient choices. And the more convenient choices aren't always, in the long run, the healthier choices. However, at the same time, I think what had a much bigger impact on me at that time was the way that I saw food and my relationship to food, not the timing. And I think I think there were things, because I didn't recognize what my relationship with food was, I found other reasons as to why my lifestyle was the way that it was. And for me, having a busy lifestyle was an easy one to point a finger at and say, that's it. And I want to make sure I'm not coming across in the sense that people, that isn't a real thing. That's why I started by saying that there is an element to that. And I'm not telling people that they can't use that as a reason, because it is. But at the same time, my relationship with food had such a bigger impact on how I saw food, how I chose what food to eat, why I was choosing certain foods, why I was picking. Because there's, you know, I'm privileged to have money, and I'm privileged to be middle class. And so the socioeconomic impact of being able to choose certain foods wasn't impacting me to an extent as it does to a lot of people in this country and around the world. But at the same time, I was still making choices that I didn't necessarily have to make, and I was making them out of the wrong reasons.
Well, I think you've touched on a point that should be discussed, which is that it's complex, and it's very rarely one single thing or one single cause. And when we throw about language, or we use words like, or terminology like your relationship with food, psychology is a very, very heavy factor here. Often it's not about the food itself. I mean, I tend to find that I described it in my TEDx talk, actually, about, it's called your food world, which is everything you believe personally about food, but also your food script. So your whole life growing up from childhood up to adulthood, all the different influences that come in, almost like a play, dictate your entire relationship.
I've got so many stories as a kid that I now recognize shaped the way that I saw food that at the time I had absolutely no idea. And it's not something we think about, I think, really.
No, and I've just come straight from back-to-back clients just now for this particular recording, and I had two very severe, I would say, cases of very tricky relationships with food. And it does bring it home. And we do have to remember, like you said, a few factors that we are privileged to be in a situation, to even be in a certain situation. But once again, it's not a choice. People do not one day decide, oh, I want to have this difficult problem right now. Mm. I want to turn to food for this, or I want to turn against it for this. It's not a choice, is it? It's definitely part, and it can be in a severe case, a mental health illness.
Yeah, and I think when we start labelling these things as choices, we start putting the onus and the responsibility on that person for their own health. And I think we start getting into quite a dangerous situation when we start doing that.
No, completely. And it takes a lot of people. So I think, like you've touched on before, as a doctor, obviously, you don't get as much or if any nutrition training. Mm. So it's very important.
Six lectures, maybe, in 6 years.
Oh, gosh.
Something minimal. There's more happening. But when I was at uni, about that.
Yeah. I mean, what advice would you give to somebody? So let's say someone had come in and they happened to tell you, you know, I don't think I can prioritize my food right now, and you think they're going through something similar. How would you tell them to go about addressing that, or where would you send them?
Oh.
This is the thing.
It's a million-dollar question, because otherwise we'd all have the solution to all of this kind of stuff, wouldn't we?
We would.
What I tend to say, because I do get a lot of people messaging me on Instagram and over social media, and I can't... Ethically, I can't give out certain bits of advice to everyone that ask me these things. It's so important. It's just, I mean...
I wish we could, but we can't.
No.
We can't.
I mean, I can't give out personal medical advice over Instagram. There are very, very good reasons why that might be. I mean, as a doctor, I didn't learn to diagnose people based on text. I learned to diagnose people based on examining them, talking to them, looking at blood tests, looking at other investigations. Mm. You know, and you can't do that over Instagram.
No.
And so I'm doing people a disservice if I pretend like I can. And I think the same goes with any real profession. Mm. Some of them aside, obviously, but I think any healthcare profession, I would say most definitely there's a limit to what you can advise. But what I do say to people when they ask this kind of stuff is I say, look, the first thing that I think you need to do is have a look at your relationship with food.
Mm.
And then the next question is usually, well, what does that mean?
Yeah. So how would you define a healthy relationship with food, let's say?
I think a healthy relationship with food is going to look different for everyone.
Yes.
But one of the things that I tend to ask people is, are there times, I think one question is, are there times when you feel afraid around food, when you feel guilty about food, or when you think that individual foods have huge impact on your health or your worth or your well-being?
Mm.
That's one of those kind of questions. And a lot of the time people go, oh, no, I don't know, none of that.
Mm.
And then I kind of rephrase it in a different way and I kind of say, okay, so let's say I get to pick, allergies aside, let's say I get to pick a meal.
Mm-hmm.
You have absolutely no say in it.
No control.
And I give it to you and you have to eat it. Would you feel comfortable about that?
Mm.
And most of the time it's no.
Yeah.
I go, well, why not? And you go, well, because you might give me this. And I go, well, what's wrong with that? And then we kind of get into this and we go, oh, okay, fine. So maybe there is something there.
Mm.
You know, would you not be happy if I gave you a plate of just pasta? And if not, why not?
Yeah.
You know, it's those kind of things where, obviously, as I said, allergies and ethical quandaries aside, I think a healthy relationship with food looks like one where you don't have fear around food. Mm. You're not basing your choices around food on fear or guilt.
Yes.
And it's those two emotions I think are really rampant and quite rife. And when you start making choices from a place of freedom around food, it becomes a lot less problematic for things like moderation.
Mm.
It becomes a lot less harmful to be picking healthier foods. And it seems so silly to kind of say it like this.
Not
but
at
it's
all,
something
but it becomes
that,
enjoyable as well.
Yeah, of course. But people don't really understand that sometimes, and I definitely didn't. And I kind of felt like, well, what's wrong if I'm not allowing myself to eat the unhealthier, in quotes, foods? Like, what's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that. And I'll get that question a lot, and I'm going, but why are you not allowed to eat them?
Mm.
Is it because you are actually making a conscious choice about your long-term health and that kind of this? Or actually, is there an element to fear around that?
Is it a rule that we've had created that people live by? And this is why I wanted you on to discuss, obviously, coming at it from an angle as a medic, you know, a doctor. And for myself as a nutritionist with training in this field, it's a very... a very tricky, complex area. And it can go one step further, of course, if people have a constant fear of shape or weight gain, that kind of thing that controls their lives every day. So it becomes debilitated. They can't do their daily activities because they're so worried about food in a social setting. That's when it becomes even more severe.
Of course.
And I think also when coping strategies are lacking for so many of us, like when we're stressed or we're sad, and there's this theory called Auerbach's hunger theory where we have 10 different stages, and we eat when we're celebrating, we eat when we're sad, when we eat when we're happy, like you name it, every emotion we turn as human beings.
Well, food's great.
Food is great. You got it. You got me. So I think when you weigh all of that up, it is very, everybody's relationship with food is completely unique to them.
Yeah.
So you cannot put a one size fits all approach on working with any single individual when it comes to nutrition. Mm. And this is the biggest battle I have in my clinic. Because, of course, no one will ever be the same. There's no one approach. No, I get the same questions all the time. What if I try intuitive eating, or if I try the 5-2, or if I try fasting, or would this method work for me? And I'm like, well, it is finding a combination of any method that will work for you.
And rather, it's also than a question of work in what sense?
Precisely.
What are you doing it for?
Exactly.
Because I'd touch on that slightly and just say my opinion on intuitive eating, for example, is I don't necessarily think it's a method. And I think when people start using it to do certain things,
there
then it becomes
go.
A method.
Exactly.
You know, like it's not a method for weight loss.
Precisely.
But when people start using it for weight loss, it's not,
and
it doesn't work.
That's difficult. It's nothing to do with weight
exactly.
loss. But people come in being like, will this help me lose weight? I'm like, no, that's not the
I've
point.
I've been doing it and I've put weight on, so it's not working. So I've stopped. I'm like, what?
yeah. I know. There seems to be an overall drive on health with nutrition related to particularly losing weight. So I often get this, the stigma of being a nutritionist myself is, oh, let's go see a nutritionist to lose weight, rather than what about optimizing your concentration or your mood or your happiness every day? And you also have spoken a lot about weight stigma. Can you explain, first of all, that term? It's something obviously you've experienced and something you must see happen quite frequently.
I would say, I mean, weight stigma itself is a way of describing discrimination or assumptions about a person based on their size. There are just so many negatives, and there are so many different impacts that weight stigma has on one's health, one's overall health.
It's so sad.
There's a large element from a psychological perspective,
a huge
element. And so one of the first things that we tend to mention with things like weight stigma is things like depression, anxiety, disordered eating itself, things such as actually upsettingly suicidal thoughts, suicidal behaviors, because it has such a massive impact on our opinion of ourselves, on our self-worth and our self-belief. Now, aside from that, it also has other impacts on our physical health too. So we know that there is a correlation, and it's not 100% set in stone. However, we can see quite clear correlations between people who are subject to weight stigma and things such as metabolic syndrome, things such as chronic inflammation, because inflammation is a wonderful buzzword at the moment, so might as well stick that in.
Yeah, everywhere. Well, let's not bring celery juice into this today.
And also, at the same time, just overall mortality. And that's quite a scary thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that there are going to be some kind of science-inclined people listening to that and going, okay, that's all well and good, but maybe that's just the person's size. Like maybe maybe it's people at a bigger size that means that they have, a higher mortality.
Yeah.
But the thing is that these correlations and these studies have almost all of them, and I can send you some of the links, but I can't remember which one off the top of my head, but almost all of them show this same effect irrelevant of size. So when you take two people of the same size in terms of BMI, which is another whole other conversation, when we take two people of the same weight at the same height, and one of them is subject to weight stigma and one of them isn't, the one subject to weight stigma still has all of these negative correlations with them. And so it's not the weight that's causing this, or it doesn't seem to be.
Yeah.
And so we need to stop kind of disregarding all of these negative effects based on assuming that it's just because, you know, having lots of fat has all of these negative effects. And I think we're doing people a disservice when we do that.
Oh, it's far deeper than the appearance and the actual fact of the weight itself.
Oh, yeah.
As you've said, and I think weight stigma does materialise a lot in social media. I think the problem is that we live in two worlds now. We live on our phone and we live in the real world. And it's very easy to blur the two together really quickly. And if we are surrounding ourselves with the same ideal body type image or thoughts or phrases every single day when we walk into a shop and we see a mannequin of a certain size or a slogan on a shop wall or a gym, we are surrounding ourselves unconsciously, let's say, with an ideal.
Yeah, it continues to instill in us the link between weight and worth, which is absolute nonsense.
To
use the polite phrase.
Yes.
I'm not quite as polite on my Instagram, but I'll be polite here for you.
Thank you. Appreciate
but,
it.
Oh, it's just, it's such nonsense.
Yeah.
Our weight does not equal our worth.
No.
And we can't argue that. Like, there's no good argument to say that it is.
But that's the true defining character, the fact you're a health professional. You will never find a decent health professional saying it is their way or the highway. Literally, when it comes to seeing these things and discussing weight stigma or saying this is the answer, this is it. No health professional would ever do that because it is complex. It is so much deeper.
The difficulty I see is that I see some of them doing that though. And I guess to slightly rephrase that would be like no good health professional.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that, sorry guys, no good health professional will
just because,
ever
because again, be the, so dog- as I said at the beginning, you know, we've put ourselves as health professionals into this kind of situation, I think.
Yeah.
And there are numerous and endless stories of people going to their doctor or going to a healthcare professional and being told something that's completely irrelevant, being told something that is an assumption or a stigmatism about their weight. And being given advice off the back of that when that's not what they came in to see the doctor for.
And then they've left with even more thoughts and feelings in their heads. No, this is just it. And you speak about giving ourselves, like you've mentioned earlier, permission to eat. If you could,
unconditional permission.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's also one of the principles of, we've discussed earlier with intuitive eating.
It's number one.
There you go. So if you want to delve into that a little bit and how you found that working alongside an NHS kind of environment with other doctors, do they understand you when you talk about this with them? How does that go down?
I get teased quite a lot around some of that stuff, but I'll start.
Okay.
I would say that I kind of unconditional permission to eat, I think, is probably one of the most misunderstood concepts of intuitive eating.
Yes.
And I think the reason being is that it still comes from a place of fear. It still comes from a place of going, hang on, but if I give myself unconditional permission to eat, I'm just going to eat donuts all day because that's what I want.
But then they realise once they couldn't physically do that, I'm sure.
Oh, exactly. And but you then start making choices based on something else. So at the moment, you might want donuts all day. And so, you know, I'm going to ask you, fine, today you're going to eat what you want. You're going to eat what you crave, what you're wanting. And you might go and eat 8 donuts, let's say. Along with unconditional permission to eat comes other tenets in regards to honoring your hunger and respecting your fullness and kind of respecting your body and how you're feeling. Yeah. And so you get to the end of the day after eating 8 donuts. Let's say you haven't eaten anything else but 8 donuts all day. How are you actually going to feel? You're going to feel lethargic. You're going to feel tired.
Oh, your digestion, I dread to think.
Exactly. You're gonna try and go to the toilet and it's not quite going to work. So, but you know what? That's then going to lead, or should, if we're then kind of looking at this, if we're starting this in the right place and we're kind of in the appropriate mindset to be able to look at this kind of stuff, that should then lead to a realization of, okay, so 8 donuts doesn't actually make me feel very good. And soon, having 8 donuts is going to completely lose its value. It's going to lose its kind of excitement. But it has that excitement because we've spent however many years telling ourselves that donuts are bad and we're not allowed them.
Yeah.
And that I get a lot of questions about binging as well. And binging comes, from a psychological perspective, comes from a place of restriction. And when we stop restricting things, we may have this kind of almost kind of rebound effect. But if we stay on with this kind of stuff, and this, I promise, isn't me trying to give people advice over without seeing them.
Of course.
But you know what I mean? You know, when we start giving ourselves this permission to not restrict, we lose the binging loses its impact. Not 100%, but it definitely has. There's definitely a change there. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, being able to moderate what we're eating is much easier and much less problematic when it's coming from a place of freedom. So when we're free to choose what we want, because we have unconditional permission to eat what we want, we then are able to start making choices for health,
of course,
without them being based on fear and restriction and guilt.
Which is why definitely separating the two ideas of, like we go back to discussing at the beginning, if you go to somebody and say, I want to work on these principles, but I want to lose weight, it really is letting go of that aspect.
Yeah, because that whole mindset is
what's causing the problem.
And you can't really give yourself unconditional permission if you're still making all of your choices based on the assumption that your current and only important goal right now is weight loss.
Yeah, and I think, like you mentioned of binging, obviously that's a very good point, and a lot of binging does evolve from that process. But of course, for some people, it may have, you know, different components too.
Of course, so, it's nuanced.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it won't be for everybody. But you've mentioned a really crucial point as well, in that it's not somebody's willpower why they binge. They can't just switch it off. It's not a choice again. And I hear a lot. Let's discuss social media. So I hear a lot of things.
Who do we start with?
Who do we start with? Well, we don't name names on this podcast.
This is the I do on my page if you want to come.
Yeah, it's fine. Okay, yeah. Go to Joshua's page. This is the PC podcast. so when it comes to looking at misconceptions that calories in equal calories out is everything, that obviously wouldn't help explain situations even like binging. Because, for instance, somebody could be binging and not having more calories than their daily intake, let's say, and then they're still restricting. But instead of losing weight, they're gaining weight because of the binge process and the fluctuation and the types of food. What is your viewpoint, first of all, on calories in, calories out, in terms of when it comes to being mindful of what's in the food?
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So it's a very long-winded type of question.
It's also not an easy answer,
it's
either.
It's not. And every health professional has a different view. We had Dr. Giles Yeo on before explain the genetic kind of factors.
Well, I heard someone say the other day, and I think I really like this as a kind of analogy. I heard someone say, and I can't remember who it was, say that telling someone that weight loss is as simple as calories in, calories out, is the same as telling a boxer that winning is as simple as just not getting hit.
Ooh.
And I really liked that because it completely, like, you wouldn't tell a boxer not to get, like, obvious, like, that makes sense, right?
Because
like,
there's so much more involved.
Yeah,
there's technique
course.
In the game. Not that it's... I know anything about boxing, by the way, but I'm sure there's a bit of technique there.
But or tennis. It's like saying, you know, just hit the ball over the net.
Yeah.
In
the
right
get
place.
The tennis analogy works for me better than the boxing.
I thought it might.
Yeah.
But it's, so I think, just like you could argue, yeah, but a boxer shouldn't get hit. Mm. It's like, okay, but let's look at what it actually takes not to get hit.
Yeah.
And if we ignore all of that, then we're going to fail at the first hurdle.
Yeah.
And so when we look at things like calories in, calories out, we know that the science is there. Like, it's not...
Everyone knows that.
We know energy balance. We know that, you know, but we're not robots.
No.
And so if we were a robot... and we gave that robot more energy than it, you know, that energy would have to go somewhere.
Yeah.
But because we're not, we're ignoring all of the other things that impact calories in and calories out. Mm. And so I just, to make it clear, calories in, calories out is always scientifically accurate.
Of course.
But there are so many things that impact calories in and calories out. Yep. And that does include types of food, how much we can absorb from types of food.
Yep.
But at the same time, I think there are some people that are taking it slightly too far.
Mm.
And so, for example, like not eating late at night, there may be some good reasons why it might be helpful for you not to eat late at night.
Yeah.
But people telling you that the food is going to make you fat if you eat late at night.
Past 6 p.m. Yeah, I get all sorts in the clinic. Yeah.
And you know, you could, if you want to go really scientific, you could delve into the circadian rhythm and you could delve into, actually, maybe we actually do absorb slightly more calories from the food, but it's negligible in the long outcome of going...
And lifestyle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's so much stuff there. And it's... And I think we are taking it the other way too far. So I think, I don't know whether I've gone around the houses slightly, but calories in, calories out is scientifically accurate.
Yeah.
But we're missing a lot of nuance when it's all we focus on.
Yeah. I like using the two keys whenever I discuss someone's nutrition in general, which is the quality of the diet and the quantity of the diet. And those two factors will be unique to everybody. So one calculation that is based on science to work out your basic amount of energy you need every day versus how much you need on top of the activity you take part in cannot physically ever be 100% accurate because it's just a calculation.
Mm.
We're all unique human beings. So there has to be a margin of error there somewhere for people to take into account where they might need a bit more or a bit less than what the number's telling them.
Which is why I'm not convinced that calorie counting as a method is a lifelong...
No.
You know, a kind of a feasible thing to be doing from a lifelong perspective. Because there's so much stuff that, you know, even just aging affects that calculation. And so we're going to be spending our whole life trying to work out the nuance, looking at what happened the previous day. And it's a lot of mind space to be dealing with when our whole life revolves around food.
It's like, true. I mean, it has a place. And I would urge anybody listening to be aware of the energy in your food, but don't take it as gospel like it's the most crucial part or component every day. And for some people, you're much better off rejecting that mentality altogether and just focusing on what you're eating as if you like it, rather than counting about the numbers. But if we move on from that, because that's quite an eye-opening, deep topic there.
It's a whole nother podcast all by itself.
I think I could do a whole podcast easily on calories, but to be honest, my own ethos around it, I don't know if
it might not help either. That's the problem, you see.
It would make it worse. Yeah. What is your view on how social media has affected other people's relationships with foods?
It's a double-edged sword,
okay,
unfortunately.
Agreed.
So I'd like to say that the stuff that I do on it, for example, is beneficial to people's relationship with food.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope it is.
Mm.
But at the same time, a lot of my content is based around calling out and kind of acknowledging that what other people are saying isn't helpful.
Mm.
So there is a lot of stuff on there. I'm never going to run out of content to be able to do that. And that's, in one way, a good and a bad thing.
Yeah, it's a very different approach to the approach I take. Yeah, which is why it's very interesting to hear.
So there are so many people giving their opinion as fact on social media. And social media itself gives a voice to people who normally wouldn't necessarily have a voice. And sometimes that can be a great thing.
Oh, it's definitely double-edged, isn't it? Sometimes that can be amazing. Though,
yeah.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, marginalized groups and discriminated against groups. And, you know, there will be people, for example, when we go back to the weight stigma thing, there will be people who have never actually seen a person of a larger size, really, without much clothing, for example.
Mm.
Yet, if we look at all of the kind of swimwear adverts and all that kind of thing, I mean, even so, there's a limit to how large a person they will use for those kind of adverts.
Mm.
And so, for example, in that setting, social media is giving a voice to that kind of marginalized group.
Oh,
and it's great to see that
it?
Kind of stuff.
Yeah, 100%.
At the same time, it's also giving a voice to people who have opinions which are pretty discriminatory.
Of course.
So taking that one step further in regards to food, there are people who have opinions that aren't evidence-based.
That's my biggest concern, definitely. And I know yours too.
Yeah, and they're portraying those opinions as fact, and they're cherry-picking data, they're cherry-picking studies, and showing them to the masses who don't really understand how to read or critically analyse studies.
There and that's are studies not for their, and against their responsibility. Everything. Yeah.
Exactly. But they're using that kind of stuff to convince people of a certain way of living based on how they look. And it all comes back to the visual side, especially when we come to Instagram. It comes back to the visualization of health and people assuming that health looks a certain way. So they find someone that they like the look of and they assume they must know what they're talking about because otherwise they could never have got to that in the first place.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's...
This is the part that I find particularly worrying. So I've personally never, ever done a what I eat in a day post on social media. I never will do. It's not helpful to anybody, especially as I think people need to acknowledge that they have a position of influence on social media. You could have 100 followers, you could have 10,000. You still are going to be showcasing something.
Sometimes
to someone
your
else.
Impact can be more harmful when you've got less followers in the first place, anyway, ironically. So,
yeah, exactly. They'll be more inclined to be following your every move. Mm. You know, you don't know. And I think the real danger is the anecdotal advice, as you've just said. So, somebody getting up the same, well, it worked for me, therefore it will work for you too. And I see so much of it on social media these days with lots of different accounts popping up left, right and centre and big concerns of people crossing over into areas they shouldn't be discussing as well. So I think skinny coffees and teas and I can see the look on your face right now because they're making a lot of money, aren't they?
Mm.
Like, and now...
Far too much. They're feeding off people's want to lose weight.
Vulnerability.
Irrelevant as to whether that's actually going to make a positive impact on their life.
And
it makes a lot of money.
it does make a lot of money. But as you know now, NHS England's medical director recently urged that social media companies actually clamp down on the adverts for these type of products. What do you think this will have an effect?
I'm trying not to be skeptical.
Okay, let's be really
in an optimistic way. Yes.
Yeah.
If the problem is, I don't know how they draw the line because it's. I mean, from my perspective, I think it's quite easy to determine whether or not these things are based on science or rooted in science. But all it takes is one of these companies to start making a different claim, like it's got vitamins in it and therefore it's actually not about weight loss. It's just for your health. But people will still buy it for weight loss. And so there will be ways of, I mean, going back to not being optimistic again, sorry. But there are always ways of people getting around this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I think, however, it is good to have these kind of conversations and for people to start speaking out about it.
Yes.
Because the more that people speak out about it from a place of authority, the more that the layperson will be exposed to the alternative view. And I like to say often that when I'm not necessarily arguing, but when I'm kind of addressing or pointing something out on someone's post that isn't correct, I'm not always doing it for them. Like a lot of the time they've made up their mind. Like we live in a world where people aren't really willing to discuss things anymore sometimes.
Yeah.
But the reason I'm leaving that comment is for the people that follow them. I'm not trying to change their opinion, but I'm just trying to give some balance to the conversation to the people that might never have heard that might not be true.
Well, this is it, transparency. And even very recently, I think up until about 2 weeks ago now, so I'm not sure what date this podcast is currently airing to you listening, but we had new guidelines come in from the ASA, the Advertising Standards Authority, and they now state that all people on social media may be selling a product or if they've been sent a product for free, they should be declaring it. So I'm still seeing a lot of people that aren't, but hopefully with people actually regulating this now. So let's say if a celebrity we all know were sent a box of chocolates for weight loss. Let's call them skinny chocolates. I haven't seen them yet. I really hope these never appear ever.
It'll be your fault if they do.
I know. I don't want to manifest this. But let's say they put it on their story and say, oh, I'm really enjoying these chocolates. They're helping me lose weight. First of all, now they'd have to declare that it was actually a gifted item or they were paid to do it legally. And then second of all, they'd have to say how long they've had it for. But I think a lot of people still aren't even declaring if they've been sent that. It makes it look to the consumer like they've actively gone out bought this product with their own money, whereas they never have even knew it existed if it hadn't been sent to them for free.
I think the difficulty is even with, and those kind of guidelines are definitely good things, don't get me wrong, but I think even with that, I still think that there are a lot of people who aren't, it's not going to make much of a difference in regards to what they see, because they still value this person's opinion.
Yeah.
And they still look up to them as something to be admired and something to follow. And so whether they put gifted or ad, or even if they write down at the bottom of the post, this doesn't work for weight loss, people will still buy it.
We do need a clamp down. I completely agree.
But I agree. The less we have of it, the better.
Yeah, we're being very, on an optimistic note. But moving on from the subject of social media, just very quickly, I wanted to ask you your thoughts on intermittent fasting.
Okay.
So I obviously know from a nutritionist point of view the evidence kind of thing. What do you think in the medical world, or as a doctor, or what you've seen on social media? What are your thoughts on this? It seemed to be a big craze.
I think my thoughts would be split into two
camps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good word to put it. I think my first camp would be, what do I think about it in regards to our relationship with food?
Mm-hmm.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, I know.
My next camp would be putting relationship to food aside, even though we can't really do that. But let's say we do.
Yeah.
What does the science say?
Yes.
And so I think looking at the first thing in regards to relationship with food, I think that it could and it can be quite problematic because of the fact that it creates a new set of rules around food.
I agree.
And it doesn't allow us to honour our hunger.
Mm-hmm.
If we're hungry in the morning and we've decided that we're going to be doing this intermittent fasting thing, then we won't allow ourselves to eat. And we know that's the case because there are endless questions on social media about, but can I have this if I'm intermittent fasting? Can I have this? Does gum count? What about if I put this in my coffee? Does that break my fast? I'm like, if you're asking these questions, I'm not convinced you should be doing it.
I think it's a method of restriction as well. For a lot of people, it's another mask for a disordered eating.
It's also why. It's are you doing it to lose weight?
And the why is one I'd like you to cover, because there's lots of crazy reasons why that are emerging that people are talking about, but I don't think they're quite concrete in evidence.
No, I think there's definitely, to put it into camps again, there's two camps. There's the wanting to lose weight, and then there's the overall health, however that kind of seems to pan itself out. Mm. The wanting to lose weight, I mean, you're just restricting the period of time in the day that you're allowing yourself to eat.
Mm.
And I can definitely, if you give me unlimited food, I can definitely eat more food in 14 hours or 16 hours of being awake compared to eating food within 6 hours of allowing myself to eat.
Mm.
And so people are finding themselves losing weight on it, but it's just because they can't eat as much.
Mm.
There isn't anything magical to it. Mm. People will claim that there is. People will claim that it affects this and that, and the insulin levels mean you don't put weight on, and it's none of that is really based on sound science from a weight loss perspective.
Mm.
And we've seen that. There have been multiple studies looking at time-restricted feeding compared to ad libitum feeding, and it doesn't, as long as the calories, again, this isn't the point, but when we go back to the kind of robot-type science, as long as the calories are controlled, it doesn't make any difference whether they're intermittent fasting or not.
Completely.
And so from a weight loss perspective, I think it's just as problematic as any other weight loss method, in the sense that it can have a large impact on how you view food.
Mm.
And anything that adds more rules isn't going to be something that I'm going to ever blanket advise.
No. And I had some worrying messages from a few friends, this was last year, saying, I know somebody with cancer, would intermittent fasting help? Some people are saying it helps me cure this, and then you get into a whole other level.
Well, there's your overall health effects claims that people are having around it.
Mm.
And the problem with that is that because I like to try and be balanced, I can't say that there isn't anything promising with some of this stuff.
Mm.
However, what's important to kind of work out is, let's say that it does seem to have some impact on people who have insulin resistance, for example, which is a common one that gets used as to why people should intermittent fast. One, there's not much evidence that it has much of a beneficial impact once you stop doing it.
Yeah.
So as long as you're willing to intermittent fast for the rest of your life, you may be able to improve your insulin resistance.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's fine, but maybe we should perhaps be looking at slightly more permanent ways of doing it, because they do exist.
Of course.
And then at the same time, insulin resistance, even if you have it, isn't the only measure of your health.
No.
And so if, let's say you start intermittent fasting and you manage to improve your insulin resistance, what about the other elements of your health? For example, your social connectivity that might actually have an impact on it, because you're like, you don't go out for brunch anymore because actually no, because it'll be too hard because I can't eat because it's not 2 p.m. yet. And, you know, your sleep, for example, maybe, like, there's just so many different things that we're not taking any time to actually look at. And we're just having a very narrow-minded view of this will improve health. I must therefore do it.
Yeah.
Rather than going, yeah, but there are so many other things that have an impact on our health. And maybe, you know, as a doctor, we constantly weigh up benefit and risk.
Of course.
And maybe the benefit, the small benefit of intermittent fasting is actually outweighed by the risks for you of doing that.
Yeah, but then for some people out there, rather than intermittent fasting, it may just be having one portion of greens a week more, which would be more beneficial to their health than even fasting. You know, you just got to look at it. It's such a different...
Their insulin resistance may be massively improved by just increasing their fibre intake.
There you go, exactly.
And that doesn't require them to add any more rules around their food.
No.
It doesn't require them to ignore all their brunch dates that they, you know, they have with their friends and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, so it's definitely, I like the two camps philosophy there. There's always a for and against. So we have got some questions from followers for you.
Yeah.
Okay, now Nina has said, what do you think of the 80-20 rule, or the word rule is there again, around food? So that may answer that for you there,
it
Nina.
It does.
Yeah, 80% of the time healthy, 20% not. What do you think?
I think it's a nice way of describing moderation.
Yes.
But again, it's got the word rule in it. and whenever we start putting rules around our food, we just need to be careful. So yeah, it's a nice way of describing how moderation works, and it's a nice way of describing that there are no such things as inherently bad foods. But it can become a rule for people, so I think it's just worth being aware of what its purpose is.
If that works for you, Nina, that's fair enough. But definitely take on board all of that wonderful advice. So Sam has said, I sometimes eat more than my boyfriend does for dinner. Should I be concerned about this? This is very hard to answer these over the podcast.
Should you be concerned? No.
No. There you go.
Basically. You can't make judgment calls about.
No, we don't know what you're eating, Sam.
Well, exactly. And you can't make judgment calls about what people need for their body. You know, your boyfriend could be smaller than you. Who knows?
There you go. So Harpreet has asked, I always have been self-conscious about my stretch marks. Does everyone get them?
I have them.
There you go.
So however, that's person of one there. in terms of everyone, no. But a lot of people do. They tend to be quite a normal outcome from certain things. So for example, a large majority of people after being pregnant have stretch marks.
Yes.
And it's not something that you can get rid of.
No.
You can. So the only reason I'm saying that is just because I see a lot of people selling things online to be able to get rid of that kind of stuff. It's playing off people's insecurities. It doesn't define your worth. Like, I know it just seems so sappy, but it's incredibly true. And we need to say that stuff more often.
I think we're so used to seeing airbrushed images as well, Harpreet, just to put that out there, that we rarely get to see the perfection of imperfection, if that makes sense. The perfect, what's the phrase? Is it perfection of imperfection?
It goes hand in hand with cellulite. It's all the same. It's exactly the same camp as, it's not something you can fix. It's not something that needs to be fixed. And it's not something that is as uncommon as you think it is.
Collagen pill, everybody, is going to suddenly miraucously get rid of your cellulite.
Pill is going to do anything. It's rubbish protein.
Really fed up with seeing collagen supplements everywhere. Anyway, the last question we've got, moving on. Elizabeth says, Josh, this is really lovely. You make a really good avocado rose. How can I recreate this?
I haven't made one of those in ages. You need to find the right ripeness of avocado.
Ooh.
That's number one.
Oh, I love a ripe avocado.
But if it's too ripe, it won't hold its shape properly. And if it's underripe, then it won't bend properly. Just got to find, maybe you need to buy 5 or 6 avocados of different ripeness and try them out. And then you can, you know, I think it's kind of luck.
It's in the avocado. There we go. Thank you.
Get a good knife as well.
Excellent tip. So we're now moving on to my favorite part of the podcast. Now, this is called Fact or Fiction. You can answer as you wish.
All right, go on.
To give you a clue, somebody did say faction when they weren't sure which
way
it
went. Okay, all right. Say that for all of them.
Okay. Calories in, calories out determine our health.
Complete fiction.
Cellulite is normal.
Fact.
Artificial sweeteners cause heart disease.
That's a new one. Fiction.
Our appetite is the same every day.
Fiction.
We should trust all headlines we read.
Well, I mean, obviously that was fiction as well. They're leading. I was worried for no reason.
Yeah,
sorry.
No, you really went. But just wait till you have the next one. Drinking celery juice to detox your body works.
Ah, well, obviously that one's a fact. Obviously. No, I am joking. Just to clarify, please don't turn off the podcast and go and drink celery juice. It's veg. That's great.
Yeah.
It's not gonna fix anything magical. There's no plausible mechanism for it. And if you have delved into the science, in quotes, sodium clusters aren't a thing.
Yeah.
Just to clarify. And it's not because we haven't discovered them yet. It's because they don't exist.
There you go.
Just to clarify.
That's a very, very extra bonus there to the round. So there are good and bad sugars.
Dum, dum, dum. Overall, fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because we shouldn't be calling things good and bad in the first place, mm-hmm. and our body reacts in very similar ways to all sugar. Mm-hmm. I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay.
There's nuance there, but we don't have time.
Yeah, no, it's a quick fire. Sugar can cause type 2 diabetes.
Fiction.
Okay. We must all be a certain weight to be healthy.
Fiction.
We have the right to choose what we eat.
We should do. Fact.
Excellent. That was a good quick fire round. Well done. So that nearly wraps up this episode, but as with every single guest, we finish with a food for thought. So mine today is that everyone has a unique and special relationship with food, which we have discussed, and it can be a powerful thing when used effectively for mind and body, but if abused, it can also be detrimental to our health. Food should never be a source of guilt, and exercise should never be about counteracting what we ate earlier or punishing ourselves for eating. And we all need food to sustain ourselves. So even if we indulge at times, it doesn't mean we should feel bad or see it as any kind of weakness. Food is to be enjoyed, and that's something I see a lot in my clinic, that it's seen as a weakness, and this is not the case. The key to taking any advice on healthy eating and nutrition is to remain open-minded. Not being, too rigid or restrictive or strict about the numbers, and nutritious eating can cause problems and worrying about all sorts of things. So ultimately, to be a little bit more relaxed, which is very much easier said than done. And as we've discussed, we've got lots of information in this podcast for you to go away and ponder over. So Joshua, if I could leave you to share your food for thought with our listeners, that would be wonderful.
I think something that has been on my mind quite a lot recently is that glorifying something as fragile as health is a bit of a recipe for disaster.
Mm.
I think a lot of the decisions we make, specifically around food, are in essence to do with us trying to be healthier. And that's not a bad thing. But when we start linking our health to our worth, and we start glorifying it above all else, and we start seeing people that are healthy, and we start therefore wanting to, or what we think is healthy, and we start wanting to copy what they do and listen to them and take their word as gospel. Health is incredibly fragile, and it's not something to be scared of as such, but it's just something to be aware of, that we can't do, even if we had all the money in the world and all the power in the world, we're all still going to die eventually. Now, I know that sounds quite scary, but it's just true. And we need to talk about this kind of stuff more, I personally think. We need to be less afraid of it. Mm. But just be aware that our health is going to get worse as we age.
Yeah.
And there are going to be times when our health jumps in regards to getting worse. And we are not 100% responsible for that. And we are often told that it's our fault when something happens, that, oh, well, we shouldn't have eaten that when we were younger, or we should have been on this diet and then we wouldn't have got this cancer. And it's so harmful, and it's so upsetting to see when people start feeling guilty about their health and start feeling like they are at fault and they should be feeling bad and they are to blame. And so I would just say that phrase again, just to kind of just... glorifying something as fragile as health, because it is fragile, is a recipe for disaster.
Well, thank you so much for sharing those thought-provoking points with us and the discussion we've had today. I think if anybody listening wants to reach out for some help, I will put some notes underneath this episode on where you can go, where you can find Joshua, and where you can go if you would like some help with your relationship with food. And thank you so much for coming on today,
Joshua. No problem. Thank you for having me. That was lots of fun.
Thank you so much for listening. It's heartening to know there's such a craving to hear from expert voices in a world full of confusing nutritional advice. If you enjoyed this episode, you'll love what's coming next week, so click subscribe to be the first to hear it, and please do leave a 5-star review. It really does help get our podcast out there and hopefully help more people. For more information about my nutrition clinic, books, healthy recipes, events, retreats, and so much more, please visit Retrition.com and follow me at Retrition on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. There is growing concern around knowing where our food comes from and how it is sourced. Mindful Chef works with small, family-run British farms to source the best produce in the country. With sustainable produce in recycled packaging, their passion for sourcing food responsibly is as strong as it is for nutrition. To try out the ingredients for yourself, head to mindfulchef.com/foodforthought, where you can get £20 off across your first 2 recipe boxes and get a free cookbook written by the founders.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.